My gut hunch is that Attorney General Bondi, having just been ordered on social media by the president to open an investigation into a series of high-profile Democrats, will promptly say, oh, no, no, there's an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. We can't disclose any of this.
Mm-hmm. The senator is right. Pay attention.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, and China Lake, California. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Well, I got to tell you, since we spoke late last week on the program, I believe we have just got a kaleidoscope of corruption for you on today's broadcast.
Well, that's a pretty way to put it.
Isn't it pretty that way?
A kaleidoscope of corruption. Almost sounds nice.
It does, doesn't it? Hi, Desi Doyen. That's our producer, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
She'll be ringing in at various points throughout the program.
As
no
I
doubt,
do. Yes.
As you do. So that's what we got for you on today's broadcast. I'm grateful that you and I are here to bear witness once again today, since sometimes that feels like all that we can do, at least between elections. I'll try to get through as much of it as I can reasonably get to and get us caught up on today, plus a guest, plus your calls, as time allows, at 818-985-5735 if you're listening live today in Southern California or anywhere else around the world. Among the confusing, corrupt kaleidoscope of corruption since we last spoke, over the weekend, U.S. Border Patrol agents were officially deployed en masse to Charlotte, North Carolina, in the latest expansion of the Trump administration's supposed immigration crackdown. Even if these crackdowns often ensnare U.S. citizens, it seemed to have little to do with the actual hardened worst of the worst criminal aliens that we were told that these crackdowns were to focus on. With administration's federal goon squad now in North Carolina, having reportedly made more than 80 arrests, I believe, on Saturday alone, with many more to come. And many more since the deployment of deployment in North Carolina just a couple of days ago. Also, over the weekend, the nation's largest and most lethal aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, arrived in the Caribbean within striking distance now of Venezuela, where Donald Trump has already ordered the destruction of more than 20 small boats offshore, said without any evidence to be carrying what the administration describes as narco-terrorists, killing more than 70 of them so far, totally unlawfully, in what is feared to be a precursor to some sort of broader attack on Venezuela, as dozens of U.S. warships now gather in the region, along with some 15,000 U.S. troops, the largest deployment of U.S. troops since the Iraq War. But as much as an unlawful full-scale or at least larger-scale attack on Venezuela could serve as a helpful distraction in the coming days for the Trump administration amid an upcoming vote in the U.S. House to demand the release of the Department of Justice's Epstein files that Donald Trump has refused to release, is blocking the release thereof. And what is being reported as, I believe misleadingly, as Trump's stunning U-turn, his about-face, his reversal on Sunday, pretending that he now suddenly supports the vote in the U.S. House to release the files that he could release all by himself right now, anytime he wants, without any such vote, just as he promised he would do during last year's campaign. Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about that in a bit, perhaps along with your calls on the matter at 818-985-5735 if you are in our live Southern California listening area or listening anywhere across the globe via kpfk.org's live web stream. Before we get there, however, there was a Venezuela-related-ish report last week by two human rights watchdogs that did not get the attention that I believe it deserves, that I do want to just touch base on quickly here, among a few other things today before we get to Epstein and your calls on that or anything else we're discussing today a little bit later on. More than 252 Venezuelans expelled to El Salvador under Donald Trump's mass deportation policy earlier this year suffered systematic and prolonged torture and abuse, including sexual assault during their detention in El Salvador. That, according to a new report published last Wednesday and compiled jointly by Human Rights Watch and Cristosal, a group investigating violations in Central America. The report found that conditions at El Salvador's sprawling prison for accused terrorists, known as CECOT, breached the UN's standard minimal rules for the treatment of prisoners. It cites, quote, inhumane prison conditions, including prolonged incommunicado detention, inadequate food, and other shortcomings. The groups accuse the Trump administration of willful complicity in the suffering and torture that deportees endured after being flown to El Salvador in March and April at Trump's orders, insisting that the administration ordered the men's deportation while fully aware that they would be mistreated or even face threats to their lives. The groups are calling for an independent investigation by the U.S. Justice Department, though they admit the prospect of that is unlikely. And frankly, as long as Trump is in power, I would describe it as calling it unlikely an incredible understatement. The groups are also demanding the Trump administration stop deporting third country nationals to El Salvador's torture prison. According to The Guardian's coverage of the new report, U.S. connivance in what is depicted as a systematic pattern of torture and human rights abuses evokes comparison with the scandal at Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison, which you may remember during the darkest hours of the U.S. so-called war on terror after the 9/11 attack in Iraq. That's what they're comparing it to, and it sounds justified. Quote, we reached the conclusion that the Trump administration is complicit in systematic torture and enforced disappearances of the Venezuelans sent to El Salvador, that according to Human Rights Watch's Americas director, citing previous U.S. State Department reports, recording harsh prison conditions at CECOT, the director added, quote, the administration knew that they were sending people to a place where they could be tortured and facing life-threatening risks. Noah Bullock, the executive director of Cristosal, accused the Trump administration of, quote, hiring the Salvadoran prison system as a prop in a theater of cruelty. They wanted to demonstrate and send a message of brutality, he said. The 81-page report paints a harrowing picture of the conditions suffered by the Venezuelans, many of them actually asylum seekers from the authoritarian regime in Venezuela, the authoritarian regime of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. Yes, the man who Trump is such a terrible, dangerous narco-terrorist and apparent threat to the U.S. that we need to invade Venezuela or whatever we're going to do to somehow remove this guy from power via regime change, in what is more and more each day beginning to sound like a potential Iraq-style boondoggle, if a further U.S. military assault is ordered in the coming days. These people, a lot of them, were trying to escape him, were trying to escape Maduro. Many of those Venezuelans that Trump arrested and sent to El Salvador were actually seeking asylum from Maduro, and they were supporters of regime change themselves. They wanted Maduro out as well, which you would think Trump would actually be sympathetic to. In fact, roughly half of those who were shipped to the El Salvadoran gulag have no criminal record whatsoever, the report finds. Half of them, despite official accusations that the deportees were, quote, terrorist members of the Tren de Aragua crime gang. Only 3% of those shipped by the U.S. to the torture prison had actually been convicted in the U.S. of any violent crime. That, according to the report, which notes, quote, detainees were subjected to constant beatings and other forms of ill treatment, including some cases of sexual violence. The report is based on interviews with more than 200 folks and forensic corroboration of the interviewees' testimonies. Some inmates recounted being beaten following a visit by the International Committee of the Red Cross, and on another occasion after that visit by Kristi Noem, the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, who posted a video of herself standing outside a prison cell in which the incarcerated deportees were crammed. The beatings following Noem's visit were inflicted after the prisoners shouted demands to be freed on the grounds that they were not criminals or terrorists, that according to Juanita Gobertus, the Human Rights Watch America's director, who said Noem's high-profile visit proved that the administration was aware of the abuses occurring at CECOT. The men were freed in July as part of a deal with Maduro's regime that included the release of 10 Americans and U.S. residents who were being held in Venezuela. Just want to make sure that's on your radar. Looks like we're back in the torture business. USA. Meanwhile, back here at home, the criminal corruption of the U.S. Department of Justice continues. Corruption against American citizens, in this case, with a federal judge ruling on Monday that there was a, quote, disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps, unquote, when Trump's DOJ secured an indictment against former FBI Director James Comey, a case that was brought just days after Trump publicly, in a social media posting, told Attorney General Pam Bondi that Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James and California U.S. Senator Adam Schiff were all, quote, guilty as hell, though he didn't say of what, but that they needed to be indicted ASAP. The Comey indictment happened thereafter, after the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia had refused to bring an indictment to a grand jury due to lack of evidence. He either quit or he was fired for that. He was replaced by Trump's insurance lawyer, a woman by the name of Lindsay Halligan, who had never tried a case as a prosecutor, all just days before the matter on which the grand jury eventually indicted Comey on charges related to an alleged lie that he is said to have told to Congress, just days before the statute of limitations would have run out on that matter. On Monday, then, based apparently on Magistrate Judge William Fitzpatrick's personal in-chambers review of otherwise secret grand jury transcripts. On Monday, the judge revealed that the prosecutor Halligan made, quote, fundamental misstatements of the law to the grand jury that indicted Comey back in September, using, among other things, privileged communications from the investigation that were not supposed to be shared with the grand jury, and that there were unexplained irregularities in the transcript of the grand jury proceedings itself. Quote, the court recognizes that the relief sought by the defense is rarely granted, that relief to be able to view that grand jury testimony themselves. That, according to Judge Fitzpatrick, who wrote, however, the record points to a disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps, missteps that led an FBI agent and a prosecutor to potentially undermine the integrity of the grand jury proceeding. Now, our friend, former lifelong Republican and attorney Keith Barber, who now writes over at the Progressive Daily Kos as Keith DB, he has been following this case. He reports today on the litany of apparent prosecutorial misconduct cited by the judge in his 24-page ruling on Monday, ordering the prosecution to take the unusual step of releasing the entire grand jury transcript to the defendants, who have argued, among other severe problems with this case, that this case must be dismissed due to irregularities in the grand jury process that may have irreversibly taken, well, corrupted this case beyond repair. Joining us now for a few details on the judge's pretty stunning ruling on Monday is our old friend Keith Barber. Oh, Mr. Barber, thank you for joining us once again today on short notice to help us make sense of this judge's ruling.
Well, thank you, Brad. I'm here to talk about a colorful cascade of corruption.
Yes, no kidding. All right, let's hit just a few of the problems that Judge Fitzpatrick identified here, as even he kind of seemed to be stunned by what he was looking at based on his ruling. First, Keith, how unusual is it for a judge to order that grand jury transcripts be given over to the defendants, to the defendants' legal team?
As the judge himself said, it's exceptional. Grand jury proceedings are normally sacrosanct. Their secrecy is normally sacrosanct. That word is actually often used to describe it. And usually with the word virtually in front of it, virtually sacrosanct. So this is a breach, where the word virtually actually does matter. Mm. Virtually not quite.
Right.
And so it takes a whole lot to overcome the presumption of the privilege of secrecy of the grand jury. And the Trump regime has worked hard to do that on many levels.
You write that the judge found the record shows, in particular, two statements by, again, Trump's insurance lawyer turned into a top federal prosecutor specifically to bring an indictment here, Lindsey Halligan, that he found that there were two statements to the grand jury that, quote, on their face appear to be fundamental misstatements of law that could compromise the integrity of the grand jury process. Both of those statements, you explain, are redacted in the actual ruling, but the first statement appears to be that Halligan told the grand jury that Comey's refusal to testify in front of the grand jury himself supported an inference of his guilt. That's what she told the grand jury. If that is true, that seems to be a huge violation of Comey's Fifth Amendment rights, correct?
It's enormous and it's unprecedented. That is one of those things that it's like prosecutor 101, which of course Halligan never took. Mm. And so, I honestly can't believe she's that dumb, but she certainly acted that way.
Comey didn't testify here.
It's ridiculous. Normally, even the
go ahead.
Even the most faint whiff by a prosecutor before a jury, to include a grand jury. Mm-hmm. That, suggests that a defendant's unwillingness to testify imputes guilt is sufficient to result in a mistrial or a dismissal of charges. So that alone by itself should end the day for this. We'll see what happens, but it should
now,
because that alone is just horrific.
So he did not testify. Is that in any way unusual? Certainly unusual to say, oh, you can infer that he is guilty from that. That is what she apparently did, which is way out of bounds. But is it unusual that in any way, for a target of a grand jury indictment to decline to testify before that grand jury?
The opposite. It is exceptionally unusual
right.
for a a target of a grand jury investigation to ever testify before a grand jury. It almost never happens. And normally they aren't even invited. Normally the targets of a grand jury don't even know they're being targeted by a grand jury, so they couldn't testify.
Right.
But Comey obviously did know. And apparently they invited him. It certainly sounds like they invited him, and his attorney said no. And then Halligan was actually stupid enough beyond words to tell the grand jury that his unwillingness to show up here and deny the charges suggests that he's guilty.
Look, I'm not an attorney. I'm not even an insurance attorney. But even I knew that that is not something that you can't infer guilt under the, you know, the Fifth Amendment rights, that you can't infer guilt when somebody refuses to testify against themselves. The second statement, Keith, that was also redacted in the ruling, but you write, it appears to be Halligan telling the grand jury that it did not have to rely on the record that was being presented by the government to them seeking this grand seeking this indictment, but that they could infer that the government had more and better evidence that it would present later on at trial. Now, again, not an attorney, but what?
We've got it. That's what apparently she argued before the grand jury, is that it's all good. We've got everything we need, and you can believe it when I say it. And that's even not how this works.
Even if you're not impressed by this evidence, don't worry. The really good stuff we're saving for the trial.
Yeah, and the grand jury actually takes an oath requiring for it to only consider the evidence presented to it and nothing else. So... what else can you do?
The judge also found, as you describe it, that, quote, the timing of the indictment process, according to the grand jury transcript, suggests that the prosecution actually didn't only mislead the grand jury, but also appears now to have misled the court and actually had communications with the grand jury that the prosecution represented to the court that it did not have. Again, what? Can you please explain that, Keith? What's he talking about?
It's really weird. What occurred here was the prosecution submitted the original three-count indictment to the grand jury at 4:28. And we know that at apparently around 6:40, the grand jury refused that indictment. And the prosecution then says that between 4:28 and this 6:40 time, mm-hmm. it had no communications at all with the grand jury. And the problem with that is that as soon as the grand jury refused this three-count indictment, the prosecution immediately had a two-count version ready to go, excluding the one the grand jury did a no-bill on. And as the judge says, it's impossible that the prosecution could have prepared that second indictment, appeared in court, and have drafted it and signed it and presented it to the grand jury and provide the legal instructions to the grand jury and for the grand jury to spit out the indictment that did occur mm-hmm. just 7 minutes after supposedly rejecting the first one. The implication is that the grand jury communicated to the prosecution earlier that it was going to no-bill this, and the prosecution perhaps asked about, well, which one are you no billing, so that it could prepare a second one. But something went on. The problem is there is no transcript of these communications between the grand jury and the prosecutor, as would be required, so we could make sure that the prosecutor isn't saying things to the grand jury that it shouldn't. There's no transcript of that because the court recorder had gone home at 4:30.
So it's as if you were to look at the transcript here, it looks like they said no to this first indictment, and then suddenly they said yes to the second one, and there was never any communication even from the prosecutors to say, okay, well then please take a look at this indictment and decide what you think about that. That's what we would normally expect, among other things, to be in that grand jury testimony transcript, right?
The judge says there is no reconciling this time discrepancy. The government hasn't explained it, and the judge says, I can't explain it either, so we're going to give everything to the defense team now so the defense team can look it over and advance whatever arguments it wants this discrepancy suggests.
Now, this challenge, this specific challenge to the to this case alone kind of seems like it should kill the case. But at the same time, there was also another hearing late last week in another federal court on another challenge to this same case, the case against James Comey, another challenge to his indictment that was combined with a similar challenge that was made by New York State Attorney General Letitia James against her indictment. She was also indicted by Halligan, with both of the defendants now arguing that Halligan's appointment as U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia just days before both Comey's indictment and then James a week or so later, that it, that they were both entirely improper because Halligan is not legally seated as the U.S. attorney in Virginia, and that both cases, the defendants are arguing, therefore, should be dismissed on those grounds as well. First, am I understanding correctly what the argument is that they are making in that motion being heard in a separate court?
Yeah, that's correct. I have, at least in the Comey case, there's at least four separate justifications to dismiss this before trial that are being presented. And the first one is the one we've been talking about. So that's just one of them. The prosecutorial misconduct before the grand jury is one. The one is that you've just talked about, that Halligan was illegally appointed, and that also applies to Letitia James. The third is selective and vindictive prosecution, which James is also arguing. And the fourth is something called the Braunston defense. It's called the literal defense, literal truth defense. And it's essentially that when Comey said, I stand by my prior testimony, that's literally true, even if his prior testimony was false. But any one of those four are home run shots, certainly for Comey.
In this case,
will never get to trial, Brad.
Well,
if it doesn't get dismissed for this reason that we've been talking about, the misconduct before the grand jury, which it probably will, then one of the others is going to kill it, or the cumulative weight of all of these irregularities are going to cause the judge to toss it.
And normally, defendants will often make a case, oh, I'm being vindictively prosecuted. They're targeting me specifically. That's illegal. Or what, they make argument, make motions, pretrial motions like this all the time. Usually they are, just slapped away by the judge. But here it seems like in every case, there is something behind it.
There has never been a record of selective vindictive prosecution as there is here. I have a lot of respect for how difficult it is going to be to win that argument. Mm-hmm. In 1999, there was a Supreme Court case, United States versus Armstrong, that basically gave great latitude and discretion to prosecutors as to which cases they wanted to bring, and really raise the bar to prove selective or vindictive prosecution, so much so that with a diligent search, I have not been able to find a single successful defense for selective and vindictive prosecution since the Armstrong case.
Wow.
I believe we're going to get it this time.
Really?
Yes.
looking at this, and this is on the other issue of whether she should be, whether Halligan was unlawfully appointed, it's sort of a concession that may be the case by Attorney General Pam Bondi. She attempted to retroactively ratify Halligan's appointment, as if to say, well, we meant to do that. Here's how we really meant to do it. She apparently signed documents on October 31 to that effect to sort of shore up the legality of Halligan's appointment back in September. But she declared that the document somehow retroactively should begin back on September 22, that the retroactive appointment, according to Bondi, followed on her personal review of the full grand jury proceedings in Comey's case. Now, it's weird enough to have this retroactive order. But in this case, the judge noted in the hearing last week that Pam Bondi could not have reviewed the grand jury testimony, the full transcript from the beginning to the end of the grand jury proceedings, because that transcript did not exist.
That's a problem, isn't it?
It sure seems like it.
And I have to tell you, you cannot retroactively do something when the statute of limitations has expired in the interim. If you're going to do that, the statute of limitations doesn't mean anything anymore. And that's what Bondi is trying to do. I can't see that working, but who knows?
I mean, it's just a clown show. I've never seen anything like this. Again, you're an attorney. Yeah. Have you seen anything like this?
No, you know, and Halligan is, you know, there's stupid and there's corrupt and then there's stupidly corrupt. And that he is. And it's just ridiculous. You know, the old line here would be, you know, hire clowns, expect a circus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's going on here. And at some point the judges are just going to toss it all out. I think it'll be fairly quickly. We'll see the judge reviewing whether or not Halligan was legally appointed said that he would issue a ruling by Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be coming up quick. And, you know, what occurred in the case today is really kind of still the beginnings of it. All that occurred was, despite all of this strong language from the judge, was an order that the defense gets to see all this grand jury information that the judge has already ruled. So mm-hmm. that gets handed over to the defense now, and then the defense takes whatever facts are in there. We can infer quite a bit from it and advances its arguments that the case should be dismissed because of what the judge has already found is a strong suggestions of misconduct by the prosecution.
If she is in fact found to have been unlawfully appointed as U.S. attorney, and by the way, this has now already happened three different times during the second Trump administration in New Jersey, in Nevada, and out here in Los Angeles, that the appointments of these U.S. attorneys by the Trump administration was not done correctly, that they exceeded the 120-day limit for interim appointments and so forth. So Halligan here could be the fourth one to be found unlawfully appointed as U.S. attorney, given that she was, in fact, the only prosecutor presenting evidence to the grand jury, which we've only now just learned. She was the only one. There was none of the career prosecutors wanted to join her in that case. So she was the only one giving evidence to the grand jury. We don't know everything that she said, because again, they sent the recorder home early, and so we don't know what the full transcript actually said. But if she is found to be unlawfully appointed here, since she's the only one who questioned the grand jury, she's the only one who actually signed on to the indictment, what happens then? Do they toss the case simply because the one prosecutor who brought it wasn't supposed to be on the case at all?
Yeah, they might. They very well might. In the other cases that you were talking about, the other three now, where mm-hmm. judges have said that a prosecutor was improperly appointed, they have then addressed what the remedy is, and that remedy has been to exclude the prosecutor from having to do anything more with it. But they haven't dismissed the cases. Because after all, the case was actually brought by a grand jury, mm-hmm. not a prosecutor. And so they've said that it doesn't eliminate the indictment, which is, I suppose, a reasonable position to take. But it's less reasonable mm-hmm. when the prosecutor was alone in that grand jury room. The prosecutor wasn't part of a team
right.
that was otherwise legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where that prosecutor engaged in what's, you know, some pretty clear misconduct
right.
all by herself. And where the prosecutor was clearly someone that should have been recognized as not qualified to be in there alone.
And if, in fact, they say, no, this indictment is no good because she was unlawfully serving, they can't even bring this case again because the statute of limitations, it was going to time out just days after the initial indictment happened. So that statute of limitations is gone. They could not refile this case in the future, correct?
They should not be able to. I suppose that the judge could say that as part of this remedy, I'm dismissing this case, but I'm saying that the statute of limitations told, you know, during its filing, which would mean they would have to present the case within like 2 days before the statute of limitations expires again.
Yeah.
Once again, given everything else wrong and bad about this case, I can't see the judges doing that. But it's actually a separate judge that's considering the question of whether or not Halligan was illegally appointed.
Yeah.
So,
and none of the judges seem to like what they're hearing, and none of them, you know, you've been whispering to me for months now, Keith Barber, about the presumption of regularity, that judges generally believed that when the Department of Justice comes in with the case, that they have the presumption of irregularity, that they're doing things in good faith on the up and up. And yet in issue after issue, case after case, it seems like the lower court judges are saying the DOJ is no longer due that presumption of regularity.
That's absolutely correct. The judge made reference to, you know, irregularities in this grand jury proceeding. The judge made reference to the that grand jury proceedings are entitled to a strong presumption of regularity.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a presumption and it can be overcome, and it's being overcome again and again and again. Bovino was just accused of lying twice.
The guy heading up the ICE effort out in Chicago.
Yeah, that job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is, you know, the guy casually lobbing tear gas grenades into, you know, mm-hmm. clearly, nonviolent protesters. And
well,
it's just nuts.
The good news is the lower court judges seem to be understanding that. The bad news is the ultimate high court does not yet seem to be getting the picture. Then again, I don't think we should presume regularity for them either, because they seem to be just as corrupt as the guy in the White House and the folks over in DOJ that he has put there. Keith Barber, really appreciate you helping us out here. This case looks like it's in real trouble, but we will see. The Letitia James is another case, another matter. We may have you back to talk about that one, but for now, I can't imagine this thing ever getting, this Comey case ever getting before a jury.
Just before we came on, Brad, James filed another brief in her case that I had a chance to scan. And I tell you what, I hadn't familiarized myself with that one as much as I have Comey. Government's in trouble there, too.
Good news. We'll take it. Keith Barber, you can find his work over at dailycoast.com. You can follow him on the social medias like Blue Sky at KeithDB. Keith, really appreciate you joining us today. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks, Brad. Have a good one.
You too. All right. The kaleidoscope of corruption will continue on the broadcast today after a quick break, and we will come back with the dizzying turns of event regarding the week's vote in the U.S. House on the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files that every Democrat in the House and four Republicans there forced to make happen by signing a discharge petition after months of Trump cover-up of those files and his refusal to order their release after promising to do so last year during the campaign. All of that before Sunday night's, what corporate media are calling an about-face. A U-turn by Trump suddenly calling for Republicans in Congress to vote for the release of those files. Now, why would he do that? We will take a quick break and discuss exactly why I think he would do that. We'll also take your calls if you want to get in on it at 818-985-5735 on the Epstein files matter, the dizzying turn of events over the weekend, or anything else we've discussed today or even have not, as time allows. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
Thank you. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yep. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. We welcome your calls if you'd like to jump in on the Epstein Files matter. We haven't gotten to speak about that a lot on this program. Following what the corporate media are describing now as Trump's stunning reversal or U-turn on the DOJ's release of the investigative files related to the prosecution of the late pedophile and years-long Trump best friend, Jeffrey Epstein. The phone number, if you're listening live in rainy Southern California today or anywhere else around the world via the kpfk.org web stream, is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Are these files ever going to be released, do you think? No matter how the House and the Senate end up voting on this, no matter what it is that Donald Trump is pretending to believe about this, 818-985-5735, just days after declaring that Republicans in Congress who supported the release of the Epstein files were, quote, very bad or stupid, Donald Trump announced that Republicans in the House should, in fact, vote to release the files in the Jeffrey Epstein case. AP describes Trump's Sunday social media post calling for Republicans to vote for the release as a, quote, startling reversal after previously fighting the proposal as a growing number of those in his own party supported it. Quote, wrote Donald Trump late on Sunday, we have nothing to hide, he said. Now, his statement, AP reports, followed a fierce fight within the GOP over the files and is a rare example of Trump backtracking because of opposition within his own party. That's what AP says. The president's shift, they argue, is an implicit acknowledgement that supporters of the measure have enough votes to pass it in the House, although it has an unclear future in the Senate. The bill, if adopted by the House and Senate and signed by Donald Trump, would then force the Justice Department to release all files and communications related to Epstein, as well as any information about the investigation into his death in federal prison. Information about his victims or ongoing federal investigations would be allowed to be redacted, according to the four-paragraph piece of legislation that all House Democrats and four House Republicans had to sign in order to force a vote on via a discharge petition, since House Speaker Mike Johnson would not allow it to come to the floor otherwise, as he's been running interference for Trump's cover-up of these files that Trump previously promised to release during last year's campaign. Now, the matter could come up for a vote as early as Tuesday this week, and lawmakers who support the bill have been predicting a big win in the House with a, quote, deluge of Republicans ultimately voting for it, because who really wants to head into an election year and be painted by your opponent as protecting pedophiles, voting to protect pedophiles? But even though most in the corporate media have been describing Trump's Sunday call for Republicans to vote for the release of the files, after all, as a reversal or a flip-flop, I think they're missing a few things. Number one, Trump's apparent about-face here on what he has been describing as a Democratic hoax, that about-face is itself a hoax. The only reason that Congress is voting to demand release of the files is because Trump is refusing to order their release all by himself, which he could do today immediately. And number two, the point that many really seem to be missing, it seems to me, is that if you read, it's only, again, this legislation to release these files is only four paragraphs. And the third of four one-sentence paragraphs in the legislation reads, quote, DOJ is permitted to withhold certain information, such as the personal information of victims, and materials that would jeopardize an active federal investigation. Well, were you all paying attention last week when Trump ordered, again, on social media, ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi to investigate Bill Clinton and other Democrats and their involvement with Jeffrey Epstein, and Bondi's social media reply the very next day thanking him for the order and announcing that, yes, in fact, she was assigning a special prosecutor to do exactly that? That means, of course, that there is now, yes, an active federal investigation that can thus be cited to block the release of materials that might jeopardize that investigation. Isn't that handy? That, even though, by the way, don't forget, just a few months ago when announcing that they would be releasing zero Epstein files, Bondi, the Attorney General, and the FBI Director Kash Patel, they both stated that the investigation was complete, they followed up on every single loose end, and there would be no additional charges or investigation needed into the Jeffrey Epstein matter, case closed, end of story. Remember that? But now, it's case open again? I guess, just in time to use the old, can't jeopardize an active federal investigation ruse to cover it up. That seems to be what is happening. So sure, Donald Trump doesn't mind if they vote in favor of it because the DOJ will just say, nope, can't turn it over, active investigation. Any thoughts on that or how you see all of this moving forward somehow? Will the full Epstein files ever see the light of day, at least while Donald Trump is in office and is said to be cited many, many times in them, along with his years-long best buddy, Jeffrey Epstein? And by the way, if they are released by whatever means, do you think it's even possible that Trump's corrupt DOJ hasn't already removed whatever incriminating information that has resulted in Trump fighting so long to prevent the release of these files? 818-985-5735 is our phone number. If you've got any thoughts on this, let me go to Sandra in Los Angeles. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing okay on this sloshy day.
Yep, good. What's your thoughts on the Epstein matter here, Sandra?
I think one of the reasons for the delay for not releasing those files is because I believe there are a lot of people in high places in those files.
Yeah. But why
That's my belief.
But why would Donald Trump want to protect them, Sandra? Why would he care about protecting, Bill Clinton or Larry Summers, the president of Harvard? Yeah.
Well, I believe there are. That's funny you mentioned names. I think he may have some friends, some judges, some senators, or people that he has affiliated himself with that he might have respect for. And to protect them, those files have been delayed because, you know, if the Prince of England was already implicated, and I just read the other day, someone else was in high place, was implicated, that's another reason.
But Sandra, you seem to be, but what about Trump being in those files? Wouldn't that be the simplest explanation?
He might be in those files as well.
Yeah, that seems to be the biggest concern. I mean, since when has Donald Trump ever gave a damn about protecting anybody else but himself?
Well, when money's involved and interests are involved, you know and I know our government is corrupt. It has exposed itself.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sandra. I appreciate that call. 818-985-5735. Let me go to Patricia in San Gabriel Valley. Hey, Patricia, welcome to the broadcast.
Hello?
Patricia, do we have you there?
Yes. Yes, I did have a comment I told Miguel. My thinking, the Epstein files won't be released. There'll be another lie, another cover-up. And I think he would even start the war with Venezuela as a way of saying, now we cannot do anything. We have a war in our hands. That's my only comment. But, I just thought of it.
Yeah.
No reason. It's just intuition. It just popped my head. And I never call a talk show like yours or any of it. But that just resonates with me. Well, I just feel there might be a link, and I wouldn't hold my breath myself.
Well
thank
don't,
you.
Don't
love your show.
Thank you, Patricia. Don't be a stranger. Glad to have you call in.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you. I love you, Brad and Deb.
Thank you. Love you back. All right. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Thomas Massey, the co-sponsor, the Republican co-sponsor of the bill, he was on Sunday on ABC's This Week. Now, you heard at the top of the show today, we started with Senator Chris Coons of Delaware offering sort of the same concerns about this new pretend investigation, ultimately preventing the release of those files, which is why I think Donald Trump has suddenly turned around and said, oh, yeah, that's what it says in the legislation. Fine, let's vote for it because we'll block everything. Here is the Republican co-sponsor of the legislation and of the discharge petition, Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky, expressing that very same concern on Sunday on ABC's This Week.
I'm hoping to get a veto-proof majority on this legislation when it comes up for a vote. And, you know, the president's been saying this is a hoax. He's been saying that for months. Well, he's just now decided to investigate a hoax if it's a hoax. And I have another concern about these investigations that he's announced. If they have ongoing investigations in certain areas, those documents can't be released. So this might be a big smokescreen, these investigations, to open a bunch of them to as a last-ditch effort to prevent the release of the Epstein files.
Yep, that sure is what it seems like to me. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. Let's go to Daryl, who's driving on the 101 freeway in the rain. Be careful out there. Daryl, welcome to the broadcast, sir. Hope you're using hands-free microphones. Oh, Daryl, are you there? There we go.
Yeah. Thank you for another great show, Brad. I just wanted to suggest there might be a silver lining to this.
Yeah.
If we could make a deal with Trump to avoid prosecution or impeachment, if he volunteers which countries have been blackmailing him for his pedophilia. I suspect that the hold that Putin has on him that he's never been able to admit was not some pee-pee tape, but a pedophilia tape.
Mm.
And I think it's pretty clear that Bibi Netanyahu also has some pedophilia evidence against Trump. So if Trump comes clean on that, then we ought to let him go.
Now, what gives you the idea? I mean, we know where the reports come from, Russia, that they have something on Donald Trump that's been rumored and various reporting on that for years. Why Bibi Netanyahu? That seems kind of random to toss in there, no?
No, actually, there have been a few reports, and I cite some on Breaking Points, if you follow them on the internet, that have mentioned that certain Israeli officials have even mentioned that they have Epstein files on Trump.
Mm.
And again, philandering wouldn't be enough, I think, to shame him, but pedophilia would be enough to cause some fear.
Well, there's certainly some reason he doesn't want to release that. Thanks, Daryl. I appreciate that call. Please drive safely out there. 818-985-KPFK. There's some reason that he doesn't want to release him, and we don't have the audio tape, but he was asked by a reporter, well, if there's nothing, if it's a hoax, if you did nothing wrong, why don't you want to release? And he was like, be quiet, shut up. Literally said that to the reporter. I think it was on Air Force One when she was saying, well, why wouldn't you just release him if it's such a hoax? Bob in Sherman Oaks, welcome to the broadcast, sir. Oh, Bob, do we have you there?
Yeah.
Hey, Bob, you're on the air. What's up, brother?
Well, there are a number of reasons why Trump would be advocating release of these files at this point.
What are they?
Two of them would be the fact that so much delay and stalling has allowed for the 1,000-plus people, FBI and others, who he set to the task of cleansing it of any of his guilt, has succeeded, and he doesn't have anything to worry about in terms of what they release.
Well, what about the there was reportedly hundreds of people working on those files, looking reportedly for evidence of, you know, Trump's names or something. Those people are all right out there. Those people, yeah, they might have been able to, you know, follow orders and remove some of these things, but they know about it. They would, seems like they'd be out there talking about the fact that they were instructed to remove that information. No?
Well, that isn't necessarily the larcenous mind of Donald Trump worrying about that, because his indefatigable liar soul never gives up in maintaining denial that would, as always, squash anybody who would claim otherwise. So far, his experience is that nobody successfully stands up to him. And his whole life doctrine is to continue to deny, and his money and whatever else, money primarily, it succeeds for him.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Thinking about it in conventional ways isn't going to not going to come to a rational understanding of an irrational being.
That's fair enough. That said, there's, you know, tens of thousands of pages, and the idea that they could cleanse them all and, okay, now it's done, so go ahead and vote for him is hard to believe. I got to run out. Let me, however, get Mo in. He's good. He's always good and fast. Hey, Mo, are you there, brother?
I'll meet you back. Here's what we got to do. Trump is transactional. So all he's got to do is give us free college education, free health care, and a guaranteed income, and Judge Wamershawn will suspend his sentence. Thank you, Bradley. Talk to you later.
We'll let him off the hook, huh? All right. Thanks, Mo. I appreciate that, my friend. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our board operator, Wendell Handy, and my guest today, of course, Keith Barber of Daily Kos. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we ever do, we do them all the time, like four times a week at least. You could download them all for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. Come on by, follow, say hello. Love to see you there. All right, that's it. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here tomorrow on the next thrilling Bradcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.